And welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Under the Radar SFF Books Podcast. I'm your host, Blaze, as always. Thank you so much for listening and joining wherever you may be around the world. And I have another Four Pillars of Writing episode to have for you guys. And today I am joined by fantasy author Sarah Balstrap, and we are discussing magic systems and also religion in epic fantasy, sci-fi, and as her debut novel is The Way of Unity, a very dark fantasy world. So, Sarah, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, anytime. It's a pleasure to have you on. So, I've mentioned before on my previous episodes for like four pillars of writing, the four pillars being obviously characters, world building, plot, and of course, prose. But magic system and religion is definitely a part of like the world building pillar, so to speak. But you can talk about it for days, and hopefully we get a lot of good questions and answers in this episode to you. So when you first, I want to answer this question. When you think of like these four pillars in general, like characters, plot, prose, and world building, and bring it back to your writing, how do you categorize these four pillars and how would you rank them and from you as an author?
So I started off in religious studies doing academic writing, and so world building for me is basically coming straight out of that. And I've always been very interested to know, like, when I meet people, you know, what are the beliefs, what are the sort of constructs that are underneath their personality, what guides the way that they see the world. So I suppose I have a slightly psychological idea about how religion operates. I'm more interested in how people construct their own beliefs rather than just studying a religious tradition. So I think when it comes to writing, like, the world building is absolutely, you know, about the nature of reality in that world. And it's also, you know, it has to be anchored in the character's psyche. And then, of course, like in any society, you have different variations on how people respond to that kind of religious framework or that social framework. And people's personalities come into that as well. So I think in my book, I kind of constructed the religious system around this idea of kind of empathetic closeness on the one hand, and then absolute like distance and strong personal boundaries on the other hand. And so it was very much like the world was like that, the religion was like that, but also I was kind of doing it through characters. So they are very much bound up with each other, but I do think I tend towards the world building as my sort of favorite area.
Yeah, and anyone who's read your debut novel The Way of Unity I think would concur. It's a very dense psychological study of like the importance of religion and family, and also like rebellion, and you really get deep down into the gritty. And I know a lot of readers who I've spoken to appreciate that very much. Now, on the topic of religion in a fantasy or even like a science fiction world, there's many different areas you can go down. You can be you can have religion as the embodiment of obviously faith, but a sense of purpose and a sense of something greater than yourself, and it like use it as like mind and soul energy to push the character forward. There's another area you can go down where there's a religion and it's all like, and there's a head figure with so much power and influence, but they also go down a dark path of corruption. There's another one that I've read where characters on one island have this one religion, and then they invade other parts of the world, but then they realize like that their one religion is not what everyone else believes, and it makes them think, and maybe what I've learned the whole time doesn't make sense. So there's so many different aspects of religion that you can go down. Could you tell the listeners a little bit about how you constructed the religion in your own world and kind of the path that your characters go down in The Way of Unity?
Yeah, so when I started writing this novel, it was during lockdown, and I just moved to a new place where I didn't know anyone. So I was like completely isolated, stuck in the house, two young kids sort of driving me mad. And anyway, so this theme of isolation was really kind of like on my mind, and it made me think about, you know, the way religious groups might have been kind of dealing with that, because in religious studies, like when you're looking at more recent religions, like say in Western culture, it becomes very individualized. So everyone believes something different to each other, and there's not really that sense of community that might have existed in the past. So I was just sort of thinking to myself, like, you know, how can I play that out within a fantasy world? And how can I build a religion that is actually, you know, feels really unique and not like something I've found somewhere else? So I was looking at, there's a book of religious poetry that's it's sort of from all different cultures called Technicians of the Sacred. And you read these poems and like there's certain things about them that make no sense. And I wanted that I wanted to include that feeling of you know, you go deep enough into the religious mysticism side of it to the point where it only kind of makes sense on an emotional level, like it ceases to make logical sense. And I have a background in studying mysticism and mystical experiences. So I'm going to go off on a tangent now. So when I'm reading fantasy, like I really love, I consider Dune to be fantasy. Some would say sci-fi, but I love the fact that it's all about, you know, this kind of mastery of techniques, almost like religious discipline or religious ritual, in order to kind of awaken the mind. So it's like the mind is kind of in a state of ignorance, and then through these rituals and through this mastery that different characters perform, they become, you know, more and more enlightened and more awakened. So it's not like, you know, go and get this special sword and now I've got all the power kind of magic. It's very much based on this awakening of the mind, and also the importance of having like a path to religious experience. So I wanted in my own book to have, you know, a strong sense of rituals. So there's certain rituals that, you know, are at the beginning of the book around like the burial of the dead, and, you know, every time someone has their birthday, they kind of are recommitting themselves to their faith by they sort of commit their blood to this sort of weird mixture that's then fed to these animals who are sort of the physical incarnation of the gods. So I wanted to have a really strongly ritualistic religion that then completely breaks down, and then people are kind of forced to find a way to have religious faith and continue on in the complete absence of that communal aspect. So in the second half of the book, when things have gone a little bit downhill, you have these kind of adapted rituals and adapted beliefs where it's like, okay, well, we can't go to the temple anymore, we can't perform these sacrifices, we can't even you know, attain these religious states of mind together at our festivals. How do we connect with you know, that sense of purpose and deeper meaning in this kind of situation? So there's, yeah, that's definitely one aspect of how I was thinking about the religion. But also I just wanted to go into kind of weird forms of symbolism linked to the concept of of unity. So when I was trying to think of ideas to build this religion, I was doing a lot of sketches and drawings and little arrows and little, you know, circling this thing and just trying to get like a completely different view of things, where I was trying not to sort of copy any religions that I was aware of. And so there's certain ideas that came to me that are kind of just from my studies, but I wouldn't say that I'd read any of these sources for years and years and years. So they've just kind of got all muddled up in my subconscious. And you have this concept of a kind of world spirit. And so in that, I sort of wanted to have a dualistic religion where you have like the physical matter, which makes up, you know, human beings, the environment, the planet itself, and then consciousness kind of is existing in that, but it's like two things that are fundamentally different coming together and uniting. So this concept of unity, but it's not really, they never become fully one. It's like there's always a tension between these two elements. And this concept I kind of play with in many different ways in the book. And it's also about, I won't give any spoilers for the end, but essentially I wanted the characters to be forced into a state of compromise. So it's that kind of uncomfortable synthesis of two things that are fundamentally different, that can never sort of, like, one can never overpower the other, and they have to kind of coexist. But, you know, there's tension there, and the tension never really goes away. Yeah. So I could keep talking. So
no, you.
I'll let you ask another question.
No, I enjoy hearing all about this. Thank you for sharing. So a lot to digest. First off, Dune. I consider it sci-fi, but it's in a fantasy world. So it's on a desert planet with these different tribes of people, and there's prophecies, and there's kind of like mind magic and stuff, and there's all this other stuff. So I agree with you about the fantasy element of it, even though it's obviously takes place on multiple planets in the sci-fi world. So that's one. Mm. Number two is I read your book a while ago, and I just finished reading The Warrior Prophet by R. Scott Baker in the Second Apocalypse series, The Prince of Nothing. I have to ask, because when I was reading it, I just kept thinking back to the way uni. I'm like, I can definitely see some similarities. And I know you say you're a fan of it. Is there any influence from that series in your works? Because I have to ask.
So the funny thing is, like, when I wrote The Way of Unity, I hadn't been reading much fiction at all for years, actually, because I was, sort of buried under academic books, kind of, you know, occasionally getting time to watch like a movie, but not, you know, to do much reading. So when I finished writing it and I was pitching it to agents, I could not find a single comp title. I was just like racking my brain, you know, reading everything that I possibly could. And I started that series after I finished writing, and I definitely can see some similarities, but it's an influence on me now. It might be an influence for book two, but it wasn't something that I had come across before I wrote The Way of Unity. So yeah, I mean, other books that I discovered after I'd written my first book were Christopher Buhlmann's Between Two Fires, which, have you read that?
I've heard of it. I have not read it.
Yeah, so that has quite similar concepts in it. I mean, I hadn't even read Dune until until after I'd written my book, but I would consider all three of those books slash series to be like big influences now. You know, Ursula Le Guin, I really enjoy. I mean, I wouldn't say my writing is, you know, as similar to hers, but I do really admire the way she works with symbolism. And, you know, she has like these sort of concepts about consciousness and religious influences in there too that are sort of right up my alley. But with The Darkness That Comes Before, I've read the first three books. I haven't read the three that come after it in that series. Like it's so dark. It's I kind of feel hesitant to recommend it to people unless I know that they're not going to be completely freaked out by the content. But it's just written so well, and you know, it reminds me a lot of Dune, actually. And you know, the author says that he, you know, Dune is a big influence on him. But they both series kind of get into that concept of ancestral memory and, you know, the way that the past and the people of the past and all the things that they did and thought, how they kind of within the person and influencing the present in every situation. And again, the main character, who's the kind of messiah type figure, he is, you know, one of these people who is awakened enough to see the truth of things and how they work, but he's not necessarily a good person. He's he can just manipulate people better, you know, like the Bene Gesserit, like it's and you haven't read the second book, have you?
I just finished The Warrior Prophet, so I have.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I actually think I think The Warrior Prophet is probably my favorite of the first three books. I just thought it was so amazing the way that they captured that that sense of like being taken up into the thrall of a charismatic leader, and just the way that, you know, this person goes from absolutely nothing to then kind of having this whole sort of world at his feet, basically. But with Dune, I feel like you have this sense of whatever the mystical truth of things, it's there's not really a strong sense of evil. There's like a sense that people do bad things and that power is misused and stuff like that, but it's more like on the human level. Whereas, R. Scott Baker, when he's sort of talking about, you know, these demonic characters and things, like there's this real sense of dualism. So you have that, the same concept, I suppose, that I've put into my book, where you know, you have like base instincts, and you know, they're sort of associated with this demonic principle that we don't quite understand yet in the series, and you have these creatures that are all sort of hunger, and you know, they don't have much in the way of thought. So they're kind of very almost animalistic. And then with Kellis and these other figures who are able to wield power, you know, supposedly for the good, you know, they've mastered intellect to some degree. So it's definitely, it's not a moral scale where like kindness and compassion really comes into it. It's intellect and mastering philosophical principles and things like that. So it's still a very, very dark world, even when the people who have been positioned as the good guys are kind of, you know, getting ahead.
Yeah, I completely agree. With Dune, obviously there's the quote-unquote evil people, the Harkonnens, but Paul Atreides and the Fremen, Paul realizes, like when he's becomes if you haven't seen Dune, it's a slight spoiler. When he becomes awakened and he sees like the few, he sees what path he needs to lead his people down in order to set them free, which is quote unquote the golden path. He does some very disturbing things and he knows that he needs to do that, but it's for the good of the people and the good of the, actually the entire like galaxy, if you really think about it. So, but he's in a way he's doing it. He's a good person. He's trying to do the right thing, but he might lead them down astray. In a sense, he's also affecting people's free will, even without them knowing it, with like, because like all the Fremen, they're saying he's the chosen one. He's the Muad'Dib, the Messiah, but he doesn't even believe it himself until finally he has no choice. So he's kind of like the unwilling hero, so to speak. And conversely, with the Prince of Nothing, Kellis, he knows that he's manipulating people. He's just better at putting people in where he wants them, putting them down, gaining things from them. You can see that with the female characters that he comes in contact with.
Yeah.
So it's a different way of seeing something. But I agree on how like dark that series is, Prince of Nothing. Like I actually, some of those scenes actually made my stomach very, very queasy.
No, yes.
Your book is not nearly that dark, but still.
I know, I can't, I am. It's like in my second book, I'm like, okay, I've got to kill some people. I've got to do it, you know. I'm trying to make myself, you know, make people suffer. I really don't like writing those scenes. I suppose I get into a lot of internal emotional anguish, but I don't tend to like things that are too brutal and violent. But there's I do find that always a second book in a fantasy series does tend to get darker. I don't know what it is. It's always the first one is kind of you know, you have some kind of quest and things are going a certain way, and then the second one things get worse. And then at the end, you know, you have the big finale. So I don't know why book two is like that. But I think with Dune, one of the most interesting things to me is like when you have the concept of a person, like an individual person, it's you know, morality is very much about like connecting with that person and how they feel and what is right and what is wrong in terms of that like one-on-one level. But I think as the series goes on, Herbert really kind of gets into this mind expansion territory where it's like his mind is so expanded and he has so many, well, not he, because we're then talking about his children and characters like Leto. The consciousness is so expanded that there's so many personalities in it that have done so many things that the concept of life and death has a different meaning. You know, things become about populations rather than individuals, and it's almost impossible to retain that one-on-one morality when you're in this expanded state where things, you know, don't really mean the same thing. And I suppose it's like, how can you have a God that understands everything, knows everything, is everything, you know, in this kind of huge way, but then cares about the individual person and their fate? And I think it's really interesting that the tension there when they have have you read God Emperor of Dune?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, so the way Duncan is kind of still on that one-on-one level, where he's like, nah, this is wrong, you know, what are you doing? And Leto's kind of just on another plane, and he, you know, it's this really interesting tension between those two points of view. But, yeah, I really just love world building and I suppose magic systems that that use elements of religion like that. And I mean, before I forget, I should mention Between Two Fires. So that one is sort of, it's like epic horror, I suppose. So it the whole concept is like you have plague ridden France, and you know the plague times are kind of conceived as like the spilling of hell into the world, and you know you have these characters who are on a sort of journey and a quest, and it's all about like their inner morality and their inner thoughts. So it's sort of like if you're morally weak, you know, you come upon a situation, and you know your inner weakness feeds this kind of spell that kind of intoxicates you, and then you become sort of a part of the demonic activity that is occurring. But if you know you're sort of strong of mind and you're you know able to resist those urges, then the illusion kind of breaks, and then you see how things actually are. And it's like I just think like Buhlmann does those scenes so well where you know, this slipping in and out of different states of consciousness kind of thing, but with this moral element. And it's fairly confronting as well. Like there's you know, he is a horror writer, but but I think if you liked The Darkness That Came Before in any way, then I do think you'd enjoy that one too.
Well, definitely add it to the TBR. Yep. And before we move to magic systems, because we're touching on that, God Emperor Doom is one of the most like eye-opening and deep thought-provoking book I've ever read, definitely on the philosophy side. Obviously, it's the fourth book in the series, so we're not going to get into any spoilers, but if you like philosophical like dilemmas, and you like confrontation, and you like just otherworldly, like bigger than yourself, out of mind type thoughts, you definitely will love that one. I think it's my favorite book in the series, even better than Dune. But I know it's controversial. I know it's a controversial take, but that's how I feel.
Yeah, I mean that's the one I finished fairly recently, and I haven't read any further yet. I thought I'll take a little break, and you know, because you kind of. The longer the series, the more you fear that it's going to kind of go downhill at some point. But, yeah, I've enjoyed all of them so far.
And as have I. So on that note, we definitely touched about magic systems in like the religion world. So magic systems in general, they're an aspect of world building. And there's really, from my perspective, I think, and let me know if you agree, I think there's two types of like magic systems. There's the one that I think started with Tolkien, because when he's talking about Gandalf and like the wizards, he doesn't tell you, okay, he's casting a fiery spell, he needs to do X, Y, and Z. He just does it. And there's a sense of wonder and a sense of awe and grandiose, which is the type of magic systems that I like. And then you have the other side, which is like the hard magic systems from like Brandon Sanderson, where like in his Mistborn series, you ingest a piece of like metal or steel, and you can push and pull on things like that, which I guess has a place, and I enjoy those too. But I tend to like not knowing all the details. I like having my mind wander and just go to wonderful places. That's the point of fantasy. Where do you fall on that spectrum?
Look, I suppose I like a few rules where I can understand how things work. Because I think it sort of frames the character's relationship with the magic to a degree. So things like, you know, often magic has some sort of cost, you know, it exhausts the person, or it, you know, like it brings on their death sooner, or, you know, it's often things like that, like cost. I think that sort of thing is pretty important, like for there to be consequence for the magic. But at the same time, I love mystery, but I like the mystery to have a sort of magnetism, to have a purpose where I'm kind of orientated towards the mystery. So it's kind of like when, you know, you have like 2001 A Space Odyssey, there's, you could give a logical explanation of the film, for instance, say this happens and that happens and the monolith is making the monkey smart and da 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 da. But the final scene in that film, you just have to watch it and experience it. And it sort of has this this effect where it leaves enough open where you can feel the mystery of it without it sort of being explained. So I really think you need to have some part of it that is not explained, even to have the reader sort of wanting to find out more. Like, there's got to be some aspect of that in the magic system. But I there was one book that I wanted to talk about, but I haven't read it for a while, so I hope I don't sort of misrepresent it. But it's called The Surviving Sky by Kritika Rao. So it's based on Hindu concepts, and it's almost like you've got this ashram, this community that are living in a plant-based, like, floating world. And the way that world is sort of constructed, it's almost like you're combining aspects of sort of fantasy science. So there's like certain rules, but then it's also about the way that the emotions of the people are kind of represented in the way that they can manipulate the plants. So basically they manipulate the plants in order for the plants to maintain the world. So when, you know, you have, there's like a married couple who are the main characters, their marriage is a little bit sort of on the rocks. They're having little fights and things. And the characters sort of start to have these disturbances. It's always like disturbances in the force. the magic is not working properly, and it's kind of like, on the one level, you know, that you've got the rules, and we understand the way that they work, but then something is not working. So something is not sort of operating properly, and that kind of has a symbolic function in the book, because it's sort of about you know, if you're in harmony with, you know, in your marriage, if you're in harmony with your community, you know, upholding social expectations, then, you know, all of this magic would be operating perfectly. But because, you know, the character is having problems with her position in society, you know, her position in her marriage, then parts of it are breaking down. So I like when parts of the mystery or parts of things going wrong or whatever it may be are kind of really strongly linked to a character's state of mind. So like the actual themes of the book. And I think sometimes when you get too far into rules-based magic, that connection just disappears, you know, because it's like this happens and that happens and this happens, you know, and it's the connection with the characters becomes a bit arbitrary.
Yeah, I agree with that. So with that being said, how would you say your magic system works in your world for the Honest Bears? I know it's connected to religion, but can you give our audience a little taste of how it works in yours?
Yeah, so it has a few layers, and I was trying to write some notes before I came on here, and I was like, why have I got so many layers in this this religious system? Because often I have to go back and write scenes because I'm like, wait on, you know, are they wearing, you know, the meridian, which is this device that I've created, or are they not wearing it in this scene, you know, and what does that mean? But if I was to simplify it, I mean, it's really like you have this concept of a world spirit and, you know, consciousness, which is it's sort of incarnated through human beings, but it's also there a little bit in some physical parts of the world. So there's certain stones that embody part of this sort of spirit, and also certain plants. So they've got, you know, a lot of it is about the way the characters are kind of on this scale of closeness or distance. So the ultimate sort of closeness or you know, psychic unity or dissolution of the self into the whole, that kind of thing, is kind of on the one hand in this plant called the Alma. So when you smoke it or you ingest it, it kind of just softens the edges of your not of your personality, of it's almost like, you know, you become closer with the people around you. There's more psychic connection, less barriers, that kind of thing. So the Alma has this effect on people. The stone also has this effect on people, but to an extreme degree where it's very difficult for anybody to handle being in its presence. So it's sort of like the most extreme part of that. But the way that this stone works, so the stone is called the Voyant Stone, it's sort of encased in a different stone called Blinding Stone, and then that is like a barrier or a shield. And so that is the stone that's used in this headdress that they wear called the Meridian. And basically it blocks psychic connection. It, you know, makes the mind private from others. And, you know, I kind of imagined it as if, you know, we have like a seed and then the seed casing outside to protect it. It's sort of like the inside, and this life-giving sort of conscious spirit is the Voyant Stone on the inside, and then you have this shielding protective layer on the outside, which is Blinding Stone. And you know, there's symbolism as well with that, with people with their own minds. So ways that, you know, certain techniques they use to protect themselves, or certain techniques they use to be closer with others. And so the society is kind of like everybody has a certain degree of psychic interconnection with other people. And often it works at the level of, you know, if you're at a concert or a religious festival or something, there's this sort of like social contagion aspect where people, they're not really sharing each other's thoughts, but there's like a common mood or a common sort of sense of purpose, things like that. So that's what the society is like generally. But just like in a normal society, we have some people that are super sensitive and empathetic. This society has people who are very much like that. And then through special training, they come to become, you know, they're sort of like these manipulative religious figures that we've been discussing. So they're called the intercessors. So they basically step in between the individual and the world spirit aspect, and, you know, they become a conduit, sort of controlling that relationship. And you know, they can ease people's suffering. They can sort of calm people down that are getting a bit too hot-headed, that kind of thing. But they can also sort of use their powers in a negative way. They can make people sort of lose their minds. They can make people, you know, become confused, become violent, that kind of thing. So it's there's definitely some moral aspects to the way that these forces interact. Yeah, I mean, that's probably the main part of it. Like, I've sort of repeated this symbolism like in different ways throughout the world building and throughout the story. Like, yeah, and then the actual gods of this world are kind of animal deities, and they're conceived as like the mother and the father. And it's really about like those deities are really about the individual's relationship with death. So it's all about how when they are alive, how they're kind of preparing themselves for death, how they're thinking about the dead, because in this society, reincarnation is, you know, they believe in reincarnation. So it's very much like when the person dies, their individuality is sort of, it disappears, and they sort of are broken up into their, you know, constituent parts, and kind of they're reborn, but they're not reborn as the same person. And this is actually something that when this is a tangent here. In religious studies, like when you're looking at, say, like post-enlightenment religious trends, you tend to get this mixing of Eastern and Western philosophy and religion. And it's this interesting thing where you get a lot of, say, the Romantic poets and transcendentalists and certain artists and thinkers, like they're discovering Hinduism and Buddhism and Taoism and all these interesting philosophical systems, religious systems, and they're thinking about these things at a time when, say, like the Christian church is being critiqued pretty, you know, in pretty negative light, and you know, this idea that Christianity can be like corrected with a bit of Eastern philosophy. Like there's a lot of sort of mental experiments going on in that area, and I always found it interesting the way that people would just not deal with the idea that you know, reincarnation and you know, in an Eastern context, and then the immortal soul in a Western context kind of just don't work with each other. But you know, it was something that I wanted to force together in this in this book, where certain people, like the intercessors, believe that when they die, you know, their psychic strength is so great that they can maintain their personhood even through reincarnation, whereas other people who are not so trained sort of dissolve into the mass and then are reborn as, you know, a kind of combined being. Yeah. So that's where that part is going in my head.
No, awesome. And with the intercessors, remember back, it's absolute power corrupts absolutely. And that's kind of like the basis for the conflict that arises. I won't get into spoilers with anyone. So I definitely recommend people who enjoy like more religious philosophical type of darker fantasy, the way Uni would like it. But you did have a little bit of a warning for people diving in, because it is dense. So who would you say what type of readers would enjoy your work?
Yeah, look, I mean, part of it is that I also really enjoy like poetic language and turns of phrase and things like that. And I tend to write sort of fairly compressed scenes. So, I mean, it's definitely a book that you kind of would read more slowly, I think. And I mean, I really, really wanted to have it recorded as an audio book, and I love the way it turned out. But not everybody can sort of deal with complex stuff like when it's just with audio. But I would say, like, there are some details that I think are less important. Like, I mean, there's certain political things going on. To me, like, if you can keep up with the political parts of it, that's great. If you can't, like, I think there's so much of the story that just stands on its own anyway in terms of the relationship. So it's really most of the book is an exploration of this sort of flawed protagonist, Sybilla. So, you know, if you're following what's going on with her emotionally, then, you know, that's the story, really. And I, with characters like one of the intercessors, Voldemar, he has a lot of scenes where it's sort of almost like diary entries. Those are super dense because they're more his internal thinking about religious concepts. So if you like religious concepts, those little letters that pop up throughout are going to be interesting. But if, you know, world building's not your thing, then, you know, those particular scenes might seem too much because it is very much like symbolic aspects. And I wanted to build the religion in different ways. So he was my most indulgent character really on that point. I thought I'm going to be long-winded, I'm going to be super cryptic and just go with it with his. Because he only has like a page and a half every so often. So it's not a lot of page time, but yeah. And then there's a character, Ambrose, who is very important in the second half of the book. And he's, you know, a younger character, sort of teenage level. And his scenes should be pretty easy to relate to. He's sort of not as immersed in all of the culture and magic of the previous generation. Yeah, so I think I made the book quite front heavy with some of the world building. So it's sort of like once you get to part two, that eases off a fair bit. And I think part three even more so. I don't know if that's how you felt reading it, but yeah, it's always hard to analyze your own book.
No, I would agree. The first third, maybe even the first half, was from me trying to wrap my head around what was going on. But once it clicks, it really clicks, and then you can just flow through. And I love books like that, even though it may take me a little longer to get into it. But I always appreciate it. So one more thing about The Way of Unity. You wrote it originally as a standalone, but then you decided it's going to be a trilogy, which I'm excited about. So could you talk about a little bit about why you wanted to make it into a trilogy and maybe a little bit of update on how the sequel is coming along?
Yeah, so I wrote it as a single book, and then, you know, a few people who'd read it said, you know, are you going to write a sequel? And then after about four people asked me, I thought, maybe I'm wasting like a heap of world building here by just like leaving this world, you know, never coming back to it. And I'd been reading a lot of Ursula Le Guin, and I liked with her Earthsea series that it's almost like she doesn't care to maintain continuity. There's not really that much continuity between the books. There's huge gaps of time between when she wrote them, even stylistic changes. But I like the fact that she just kept returning to that world and just giving us these different insights into, just into the world and having these little reflections of her previous books kind of in the mix there. And I thought to myself, maybe I can just write another book in the world but not with the same characters. And I thought, that's a waste of my characters. I should continue with them. And anyway, I just always had this idea that, you know, Velspar, the place where people live, and that's also the name of the world spirit, you know, they keep talking in the book about how there's nothing beyond this world. So I wanted to kind of have somebody break out and actually explore, you know, potential new territory. And, you know, you have, so they have these sea serpents, the Siatka, that are kind of all around the coastline of the entire island. And they kind of have prevented sea travel for generations. And now that they've killed them all in brutal fashion, suddenly there's this opportunity to go out to sea and sort of explore. So I started writing a book called A Trail of Stars, which is really about, you know, discovering new lands, and new lands are discovered. But then as I was writing it, I thought, oh, you know, I can't get to this point with this character without having this other thing happen first. And then I realized I just need to have a book in between. And so that's what I'm focusing on at the moment. And I think I will call it The Black Stream. So that refers to basically the Voyant Stone and, you know, the afterlife, the place where the dead go. And it's really like I'll be picking up directly after the end of The Way of Unity, and it will have the same characters, but I'll kind of be having points of view that are sort of adjacent to the main characters from the last book. So yeah, I've already got a few chapters with Edith, who was briefly mentioned in book one. So she's sort of friends with Zohar. So I had Zohar as one of the main characters. So it's going to be in the same sort of places. People were saying, oh, you know, I really like the political part of it. And for me, it was just like, oh, yeah, that's just, you know, to support the... the plot. I didn't really think, you know, that was the important bit. But then I thought, actually, I do need to resolve a lot of these things, because I've only really resolved the political stuff on a personal level. It hasn't resolved on a, you know, sort of mass scale. So there's still a lot of tensions in the mix. And yeah, it will be a sort of darker book, but I mean, I'm never going to write anything too too horrific. So
you don't have to worry about that with me. I love all the pretty stuff, but as long as it's not backers level, So Sarah, this has been a lovely conversation about magic and religion, and talking about your novel, The Way of Unity. Thank you again. Could you tell our listeners where they can find you, social media, your website, and where they can find your book and also the audiobook?
Yeah. Look, I think if you just find me on Twitter or X, as they call it, my website is sort of in my bio there. And yeah, it's, I mean, if you can get, like, I've got my book available kind of everywhere, so if you just search wherever you like to buy books, it's available in paperback, ebook, and audiobook. So with the audiobook, it's on Audible, I believe it's on Spotify, and a whole range of other audio distributors that I've never heard of. There's like 40 or 50 of them. So if you happen to be signed up with one of them, it's probably on there too. And yeah, it's about a 15-hour audiobook. So it fits nicely into the Spotify free book of the month or something like that. You get about 15 hours with that. So yeah.
Awesome. Can't wait for to hear other people who's listened to it and read it, hear their feedback. That's always lovely. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for joining me. I hope we can do this again sometime, hopefully when your sequel comes out.
Yeah, sounds great. Thank you.
Cheers, everybody.